So we need to keep a line of separation. We need to have a separation between our animals that we're trying to stay healthy and everything else. And so what is that everything else? That is wild animals. That is our neighbors. That is ourselves. You know, we want to wear, you know, different shoes, and we want to wear appropriate PPE to think about keeping animals safe. If we're introducing new animals to the farm, we want to have some sort of isolation till we determine that those new animals are healthy. So we need to think about separating animals that we're trying to keep safe from everything else that's out there.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. PoultryStar is a unique feed ingredient that includes a prebiotic and probiotic, and it's designed specifically for poultry. Improve gut health with PoultryStar. Learn more at dsm-firmenich.com/poultrystar. Natural Biologics is looking deeper to find the natural solutions to your poultry health challenges. Zoetis Hatchery Health Team helps you raise field-ready birds with a strong immune foundation. Learn more at zoetis.com.
Welcome to the Poultry Podcast Show. I am here today with Gary Flory, and we're going to talk about avian influenza preparedness and other related topics. Welcome. Welcome to our podcast.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you, Elizabeth.
This is such a timely subject. Migratory birds and other things bringing flu a couple of times a year. People get really interested in this topic. But first, I want to hear, how did you get to your current role? What did you do for school? What things interested you? Did you just fall into it? Let me know.
Yes, I fell into it. And that's the thing. You kind of think you're going to have a plan, and it doesn't always work that way. So my degrees were in biology and environmental science, and which is obviously very broad. My first job that I accepted was at Johns Hopkins, where I was going to specialize in vitro fertilization research.
That's clearly
yeah, not the path I chose. I grew up in Ohio in farm country, small area, and I just realized maybe Baltimore wasn't the place for me to go right away at that age. So I decided to move to Virginia, which is where I live now. And I did consulting for a few years, but then I started working for the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality, managed the agricultural programs. And I grew up on a row crop farm, beef farm in Ohio. So agriculture was really a passion of mine, but I didn't realize that was going to be my advocation as well. But it turned out was a great position, gave me lots of opportunities to meet lots of great people. But we had an avian influenza outbreak in 2002 in Virginia. And I worked for the environmental agency. And at the time, there was a real tension, a real struggle between the agricultural agency and the environmental agency and the industry. And so I was tasked, you know, let's get together, work towards curing that working on some issues. We had a tremendous struggle with animal mortality management. That's sort of what brought me into the field that I spent most of my career in. So we didn't have a plan, and we had a big outbreak, and we didn't have good ways to dispose of the mortality. And so we tried a lot of things and we didn't do them very good, but that really sort of got my passion for, you know, the areas of research and response. And so I've been working in that area ever since. One of those things that's an accident, but a really good accident.
Oh, some of the best procedures, processes, inventions are out of necessity, right?
Right, right. Exactly. Yeah.
At Zoetis, we bring you more than the tools for hatchery success. We bring you a team, expert support, biodevice precision, and vaccine protection, helping you raise field-ready birds with a strong immune foundation. The Zoetis Hatchery Health Team. Trusted people, science-backed processes, reliable protection. Learn more at zoetis.com.
Oh my gosh. Well, for the group that is listening today, of course, we're always concerned in the fall, in the spring with migration, because we're in North America. It would be other times of the year for other places outside of here. But can we just talk a bit about preparedness for the avian influenza? Like, what does it look like on a farm for those who wouldn't, you know, be able to understand that? And what does it look like from like a national or a governmental side?
I guess from a farm side, we first need to really consider what are we going to be responsible for? And that could vary, depends upon where you are in the world or the size of your operation. For some people, that may include depopulation at a farm level. So if you're at a larger agricultural operation, say a layer operations, you have plenty of staff, you might be involved or you might be responsible for depopulation. So preparedness includes knowing what that means. You know, do I have the equipment? Do I have the personnel? Do I have the knowledge and the skills? If it is a depopulation method that's going to require some sort of resource, like either equipment or a resource like nitrogen gas or CO2 gas, you know, do I have all of those things that I'm going to be responsible for? Now, for an individual farmer, a smaller farmer, they probably aren't going to need to be responsible for depopulation. Think about that so much, but disposal is something that everybody needs to be responsible for. And the reality is, and the challenge that I face everywhere is that, you know, ever since humans started domesticating animals, we'll dig a big hole with whatever we can't use and we'll bury it in the ground. And so that is very much ingrained in us, and that is everybody's reaction to an outbreak of any kind of disease or any natural disasters, to dig a hole and bury the animal. So that's I guess one of the areas in terms of preparedness is to think about what am I going to do for disposal? What's going to be my responsibility? Do I understand implications? And that's kind of the biggest challenge that I deal with from my consulting practice, is trying to help people understand what the implications are. So, you know, deep burial, you know, the challenge oftentimes is solely thought of as an environmental issue, and it clearly can be an environmental issue. We've seen cases of groundwater contamination, surface water contamination, all resulting from improper mortality management, but it's a disease issue too. You know, in that deep burial environment, we know very little about the viability of most pathogenic organisms. So, you know, we think if we put it in the ground, we'd never have to see it again, and it's not a problem. Yeah. And it might be true that we don't have to see it again, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's a problem, because those viruses can live a lot longer in that environment than they can in another environment. So I guess an example more recently in the Philippines, they were struggling with the ASF outbreak. They buried a lot of carcasses. They finally got the outbreak under control. And then what happened is they had a hurricane, and that hurricane flooded the area, and it flooded and exposed those swine carcasses that had been buried. And then because the ASF virus hadn't been inactivated, they ended up having outbreaks again in the same areas where they had just eradicated the disease. So I guess I start with trying to get people to understand the implications of mortality management and what that can mean from human health, a disease eradication standpoint, even a human health standpoint. We can get, you know, I was just working with Jamaica recently with the Hurricane Melissa they had there, and trying to, you know, talk about and discuss, you know, how to manage. You know, they had 1.2 million animals that were killed because of the Hurricane Melissa striking there. So it doesn't matter whether you're talking about a disease outbreak or natural disaster, we really need to think about how we manage that mortality. So back to your question, you know, from I was talking about sort of a farm level, it can be a lot of different things that whatever you're responsible for. So another area there is decontamination. How are we going to decontaminate that premise after we do our depopulation, after we do our disposal? Because oftentimes a producer is going to have responsibility there. So we need to understand what the options are. We need to understand how that works and how we can do it. And that looks that looks different all around the world. I mean, we have some, you know, heat treatment options now in the US that aren't yet options other places in the world.
Interesting, yeah.
But yeah, we see that looking different everywhere we are. And one of the challenges I see from a producer's level, if they don't understand it well, is we have a tendency to want to decontaminate your entire premise without doing the proper cleaning that you need to do ahead of time. And disinfectants just don't work in organic matter like mud or feces. So those are some challenges there. On the government side, you know, I certainly emphasize all of those same issues, but they have obviously a lot more responsibilities as well in areas that are outside my area of expertise in terms of, you know, quarantine and how are they going to do sampling and surveillance and compartmentalization and all of those issues. But it's really broad. And I guess my focus is around biosecurity, depopulation, disposal, decontamination. It's really my focus area.
Yeah. So I am just going to make this assumption because I have no idea, which is why I'm asking the question. But my assumption is that across the world, when a flock is testing positive for avian influenza, the entire flock is depopulated. Is that true outside of the US? Like that is one of the consistent responses or not?
So that is changing. The implications of depopulating an entire flock is huge. And obviously there are places in the world where economics are a real primary decision driver, right? So generally speaking, yes, if we have a barn that is impacted, then that whole barn is going to be depopulated. One of the differences is that now, just within the last 6 months to a year, we're seeing a lot more interest and discussion about, can I save the other barns on that farm? So that's something, and I think really ASF was a driver there. You know, early in the ASF outbreak, we were depopulating entire flocks. And then in some regions, particularly in Asia, you know, they were looking at, so how do we isolate animals? Can I depopulate some animals, let other animals, you know, to stay on the farm and hopefully increase our biosecurity and prevent them from becoming infected? And so we still have a lot of those conversations. There hasn't been a tremendous amount of success in many places in terms of not having disease spread, and, you know, biosecurity plays a big role in that, but also the changing virus plays a big role too. You know, we used to think about people spreading the disease and waterfowl spreading the disease, and now we have so many other factors to keep in mind. You know, we're learning more about air spread. You know, we always said it's not like FMD, you know, we don't see spread, but there's some new research out of the Czech Republic that tells us that we can have viable virus, you know, attached to dust particles and dandruff particles that can be viable for longer than we anticipated. Plus, we're seeing avian influenza in so many other species that we didn't see it in before. It's not a matter of if you can manage your waterfowl, then you're good, or you can manage your personnel, then you're good. Now we've seen it on viable virus on the fur of mice. So can we keep our mice from going back and forth between our multiple poultry houses? I don't think so. It's a real challenge. So lots of issues to consider. There is a lot more discussion about trying to isolate individual buildings and depopulate fewer numbers of animals.
Okay, so now that we kind of understand some of the differences that can be across the world for a lot of different reasons, you've supported these responses. Are there things that happen within the first 48 hours of an infection across the world that you've found really changes the outcomes, or what are the most common mistakes? What are people doing that causes a further issues?
It all goes back to planning, right? How well that we do with our planning and what we're equipped to do. So one of the interesting things that I find is that when we have a disease, an avian influenza outbreak will we'll test and we'll identify, yes, we have it. And then we're going to move on towards depopulation, as we should. But we get so focused sometimes on depopulation that we do not do any planning or considerations for other aspects of the operation. You know, all of my people are busy with depopulation, so I can't be bothered to think about other things. The reality is that depopulation and disposal, they really go hand in hand, because you can create some real challenges for yourself. The larger the operation you get, think a layer, for example, that's got, you know, 2 million birds. If you are not going to focus any of your attention on anything other than depopulation until I depopulate 2 million birds, that means that we're going to be generating that mortality for an extended period of time that's not being managed. And that can create, again, human health issues for us. That can create environmental issues for us as well. So, you know, we really need to always think about that whole outbreak response and not be so focused on individual components that we create other challenges for ourselves. So that's the big thing. We're doing better now in the U.S. with this, but this is something pretty broadly is not thinking outside of our own little silos. So an avian influenza outbreak, it is not just a disease, a animal disease issue. It is much broader than that. So now we really need to, you know, we're seeing humans being impacted, you know, to not a significant degree, but it happens. So we need to think about that. And what are the implications of that? Well, we need to be thinking about who is responding to an outbreak. Are we preparing them and are we protecting them with proper personal protective equipment, not just so that they don't spread the disease to another farm, but that's obviously critical, but we also want to make sure that they are protected as well. The other thing that we think about too is that, you know, we're thinking about the individual responder, and that is important, but we might not be thinking beyond that from the public health standpoint. So, you know, thinking to the point where we're requiring, where it's available, we're requiring our first responders to have the seasonal flu vaccine is important to make sure that we don't get that reassortment. So we have, you know, people who are working in close proximity with viable avian influenza virus who might have the seasonal flu virus. And that creates a mixing, has the potential for creating a mixing vessel and then resulting in a virus that is either, it is either more pathogenic, which we hope not, or spreads easier among humans, et cetera. So we need to think beyond that individual responder and beyond that individual outbreak to that bigger picture. And then it goes back to decontamination again. One of the things that frustrates me is when I see there's a tendency globally to use a lot of lime for a disease outbreak, which, you know, if we're using the right type of lime, and that can be a challenge too, if we're, I've seen places where they're using agricultural lime, which is really good for getting soils to a pH around 7, but it has no value in inactivating viruses. But if you want to use caustic lime, burnt lime, whatever you want to call it, we can actually shift pH above 12. But when we spread that on a farm, when we haven't cleaned and disinfected, I said this again, and you can tell it's a soapbox of mine, but we have to clean those facilities first before we start applying our disinfectants, because disinfectants don't work well in those environments. So I guess those are some of the big issues that I see is not thinking holistically from a human, environmental, and public safety aspect, and then also being too siloed. And what's my task? My task is depopulation, so I'm not going to think about anything else. And again, that applies, doesn't matter if we're talking about, you know, a backyard farm in Southeast Asia with 30 animals, or we're talking about a large operation here in the U.S., some of the challenges and some of those early mistakes are the same.
So many of the things you're talking about invoke like the start of Hollywood movies to me. Like you start in steps 1, 2, and 3, you can see the actors going in the wrong direction. And then you've got 2 hours of massive ramifications.
And ultimately that's what my job is to sort of help educate people and prepare people to not become that Hollywood movie, right? That's where we don't want to go.
That easily could be a tagline for your consulting business. Is let's keep you out of Hollywood.
I'll write that down.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So carcass disposal, you know, my idea would be bury it and forget it, which I understand is not the right process, but out of sight, out of mind. Oh my gosh. So how do you guide the key decision makers in these operations through the choice to compost, bury above ground, incinerate, or anything else? Because it's a crisis. And so their emotions are, there's a lot.
So the key is to start those conversations right now. And so that's a lot of what I do. So my roles really are research. So I do research into pathogen viability in different environments. And I'm a responder. So when there's outbreak of avian influenza or any other animal disease, I go and I help respond to that disease. But probably 50% of what I do is training and education. So I try and, you know, I hope to have the opportunities to go work with countries, work with producer organizations to do that planning ahead of time. And that planning and that training, the very first part is understand the value and the importance of proper carcass disposal, because again, everyone's knee-jerk reaction is to bury it. But I guess I should be clear that there are places where we can bury carcasses safely. So I will tell you the shift in the U.S. So back in the old days, for example, we had an outbreak of avian influenza in 1983. In the U.S., I was not yet involved in the field at that point, but we buried all of our animals. Okay, so that's what people did. Ironically, the index case in 1983 was a turkey farm. Shortly after they buried those animals, the neighbor called up and said, "Hey, my well water smells funny coming out of my sink and it tastes odd. And I just did some testing. My bacteria counts are through the roof. I think you've contaminated my groundwater." You know, I live in a rural area. 80% of the people rely on groundwater for their drinking water.
Yeah.
Many people do where poultry are raised. But it was 1983 and, you know, nothing much became of it. And all the other farms buried their animals. In 2002, I mentioned to you that mortality management was a disaster. The reason for that is that our index case in 2002, ironically, was the exact same farm that was the index case in 1983.
Oh my gosh.
And so they went out there and they dug a big hole. And the neighbor said, "Wait a minute, don't you remember what happened in 1983? You contaminated my groundwater. I've been having to treat my groundwater. You know, surely this can't be right." And the reality is the world had changed and perceptions had changed. And everybody started saying, "Well, yeah, that can't be right. We shouldn't do that." And so it was determined we're not going to bury anything during that outbreak. And because of that, we had no plan and we struggled to, you know, to come up with ways to manage it in ways that were better. So what I try to do when I'm working, whether I'm in Latin America or Southeast Asia or here in the US, I'm trying to educate people on the fact that there are implications of improper carcass disposal. Okay. And with deep burial, you know, it is something that can have implications in perpetuity. So, for example, in the U.S., if you bury carcasses, you have to do deed recordation. So there is a indication on your deed that can have financial implications for you. It can have long-term implications in terms of what you can do with that piece of property in the future. So, I try to talk about all of that, not just the environmental standpoint, because people can get numb to that, but also the disease transmission potential and also the human health implications of that as well.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, totally. I understand. And I'm sure some of the choices are made based, like you said, on size and location. So it's not a one size fits all. You need to think about it.
And I guess where I was headed with that I didn't actually say was that there are places that we can bury. So I mentioned to you in 83, 100% of everything was buried. In the 2015 outbreak, 85% of all of, there was about 50 million birds that were impacted. 85% of those 50 million birds and their associated eggs and their associated manure was all composted. So we had a very, very significant shift in the U.S. There was still a little bit of burial, you know, hopefully in places where, you know, groundwater was deep and soil type was good. So it can still be applied, but it's generally best in smaller number of animals and in the right geologic setting.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So while you're training producers and integrators all across the world, what are the like the biggest steps that make the difference? Like what are the biosecurity changes or suggestions or trainings that you find make the biggest impact?
Yeah, biosecurity is interesting because the principles stay the same. It doesn't matter where I am in the world. It doesn't matter the size of the operation. What matters is that we understand the principles.
Okay? Yeah.
And so, you know, the principles are segregation. So we need to keep a line of separation. We need to have a separation between our animals that we're trying to stay healthy and everything else. And so what is that everything else? That is wild animals. That is our neighbors. That is ourselves. You know, we want to wear, you know, different shoes and we want to wear appropriate PPE to think about keeping animals safe. If we're introducing new animals to the farm, we want to have some sort of isolation till we determine that those new animals are healthy. So we need to think about separating animals that we're trying to keep safe from everything else that's out there. And again, it doesn't matter if we're, you know, four pigs, you know, in Latin America or whether we're talking about a large commercial poultry operation here in the U.S. Separation is important. And then there's cleaning is the next principle. We need to make sure that everything that we have going into that premise has been cleaned. We need to make sure that we do a great job of cleaning our facilities between flocks. So everything that is coming on and off, whether that be equipment or supplies, it needs to be clean. The second part of that, and then the other principle is disinfection. So we need to make sure that once we have things clean, they are disinfected to make sure that we aren't bringing pathogens onto our farm. And again, how we do that really depends upon, you know, the environment. We're starting to see more and more large commercial farms that have wash centers at the gate so that every vehicle that's coming in is being washed and disinfected. That's great. May not be practical in a very small operation, but simply changing shoes or having, you know, fencing and signing you're not allowed to enter this premise unless you have been invited, unless you're taking appropriate caution. So, I mean, there's lots of different ways to keep that segregation and to do your cleaning and to do your disinfection. But those principles really need to be applied and applied well. And again, we need to be aware as the situation changes. So, for example, the current strain of avian influenza, you know, we thought about people spreading the disease from farm to farm. We thought about making sure that we're not creating an environment where we had ducks and geese that are going to be visiting the farm.
Yes.
We need to think beyond that about how do we keep starlings out and how do we limit rodent activity and how do we, you know, deal with issues of, you know, vultures, which were never an issue before that can now have the disease and other animals. So cats, you know, so it's just a different world. And it you have to continue to have an understanding of where is the virus and how do I need to keep that particular source of disease out of my farm?
Well, yeah, once again, we're just making these movies.
Yeah.
You didn't follow these biosecurity steps and now here and we are.
Here we are. Yep.
Yeah. So it's been just a theme that you're working between animals, environment, human health, like such an interesting and necessary field. So, you know, popular media, academics, politicians, I'll talk about this idea of a one health approach, combining those different ideas. So how do we use that approach to move forward to, you know, prevent, predict, detect, and respond to these outbreaks?
So the real challenge is that we tend to be really good at talking about One Health. You know, that's that One Health concept, right? We're great at it, but we're really, really poor at actually operationalizing One Health. So how do we do that? So that's something we are improving on. And actually, we can find models in places that you might not expect them, but places like Southeast Asia, where they've been challenged with zoonotic diseases for a long time, they tend to do a little better job in some places because of those that history of zoonotic mm-hmm. disease challenges.
Yeah. But,
you know, for us, we just need to think about who are all the partners that are engaged. You know, when I first started responding to avian influenza outbreaks, and I'm embarrassed to say this, it was an animal disease event. We did not communicate with our public health folks at all. We didn't communicate with our emergency responders. I can recall a situation where we had an infected poultry farm and there was an emergency on the farm and they called the rescue squad and the fire trucks rolled in. The fire trucks were very, very upset that they had to stay on the farm until they could go through a very thorough cleaning and disinfection process because their job is to be able to be at another location immediately. But we hadn't communicated with them. If we had communicated with our emergency responders, they would have known what that line of separation was and how to respond in a way that didn't create a potential very serious human health issue for someone else. Now, you know, our wildlife people are a big part of the puzzle. You know, we think about it from the waterfowl side, and that's maybe kind of the obvious source. But we engage now on all of our outbreaks. We engage our wildlife folks because they're doing trapping and they're helping us better understand who are hosts for this virus. And the scary part is we're finding a lot of animals are, you know, the host for this virus, whether it be systematic within their system or whether it's potentially just that they can get the virus on themselves and potentially spread the virus. So we need to engage with the public health people. We need to engage with wildlife folks as well. And again, how are we engaging? Well, you know, hopefully we're sharing surveillance information. So our animal health people, they need to be sharing that surveillance, you know, where they're finding cases of avian influenza with their public health people so that they can be aware and be looking for cases of avian influenza in the human populations as well. So there just needs to be a lot less silos and a lot more engagement, communicating with public as well about potential zoonotic implications so that there can be awareness of that as well. And I'm saying zoonotic, and I guess I should clarify. So diseases that can go from animals to humans or humans to animals, either way, those are what we consider zoonotic diseases. So avian influenza can be zoonotic. It usually does not transmit to people, thank goodness. But it has the potential to do so.
Oh, gosh, that's it sounds like coordination is a massive part of your world.
it is really important. And it's something that we everywhere I've been, we can do better with that. I mean, that's a real challenge.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the unfortunate ways to do better is to have experienced the disease. And that can be devastating. So I understand how hard you're working to do education on the front side. So it seems easier if someone does have an issue.
Right. Yep.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Adiseo provides nutritional solutions and services to help producers achieve their targets in a high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge. At Signify Animal Lighting, we use light as a tool, backed by science to support growth, comfort, and performance. Better light, better animals. Better results with Signify. A worldwide leader in animal nutrition, Adiseo's portfolio of products includes methionine, the full range of vitamins, enzymes, organic selenium, probiotics, mycotoxin management strategies, and palatability products. With such a diverse offering, Adiseo supports its customers with a broad range of expertise, tools, and services to help them maintain a competitive advantage. Adiseo, fueling predictable profits. To learn more, visit Adiseo at www.adiseo.com.
Do you have any resources, websites, or other material that you might point people towards if they're interested in learning a bit more about the work that you do?
Sure, absolutely. And so my website, I guess, is a place that I would point people to. It talks about these issues and the kind of work that I do. And so my company is Global Outbreak Solutions. And so that is our focus, is how we deal with that. That is outbreaksolutions.com. They can do that. I've also worked with USDA. So we have a USDA high path avian influenza composting protocol, very useful if you're interested in the disposal aspect as well. We also have a USDA protocol for livestock. Then for FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, a colleague of mine and I, we wrote their carcass disposal guidelines for small to mid-size producers. That's a really good tool. With FAO, there's also a focus on, so sort of an abbreviated version of that, that's really intended to be a more of a decision support tool. What disposal method do I use? It kind of walks you through that. Whereas the guidelines with FAO actually walks you through, how do I implement each of these different disposal methods? So those are some good resources that I would point people to, primarily focused on mortality management, but beyond that too.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for talking with me about this. It's so interesting and 100% right that just bury it. It'll be gone. Whew, that's maybe not the best idea.
not a great idea.
Well, I really appreciated hearing about some of the complexities, because each of these, the topics that we always talk about, are so interesting and deep, and I love learning more. So thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.